Good morning. First matter this morning, State of Ohio versus Jason B. Dean. Ms. Sanford.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, if I may reserve 8 minutes for a rebuttal. Thank you. As set forth in Proposition of Law Number 1 in our direct appeal brief, Jason Dean was denied his constitutional right to represent himself at his capital trial in violation of his Sixth Amendment right. Mr. Dean's assertion of this right stemmed from the heated controversy between the trial court and defense counsel that began with a certification motion and hearing pursuant to Rule 16b1e. Subsequent to the certification hearing, Mr. Dean's attorneys filed a motion with the trial court to recuse himself based on a violation of State versus Gillard. The trial court denied this motion, and then defense counsel filed a motion with this court to disqualify the judge from presiding at the trial, again, based on Gillard. The court and the state filed opposing motions to this defense motion, and this court denied the motion to disqualify.
Ms. Sanford, would you pull the microphone closer to your speak into it? We can't hear you.
When a motion to disqualify was denied by this court, the trial court told defense counsel that he had very serious concerns about the allegations in the state's response that appeared to be corroborated by the events that took place. The state had asserted that defense counsel had a calculated plan to have the judge hear the certification hearing so that they could raise a Gillard violation to get him removed from the trial. The trial court stated this was evidence of manipulation, fraud, and deceit on the court. The court assured defense counsel that the matter would be taken up at a later time. Before general voir dire, defense counsel moved to withdraw based on feeling intimidated and that it was impossible for them to effectively represent Mr. Dean. They said with the threat of sanctions hanging over them, this created a chilling effect and Mr. Dean needed new counsel. Then they put on the record as well that Mr. Dean had concerns about them continuing to represent him. The motion to withdraw was denied. The following day, Mr. Dean put on the record that he was uncomfortable with his defense counsel continuing to represent him, and he would like to seek counsel elsewhere or represent himself. Mr. Dean and defense counsel urged the court to address this ethical issue now so that it would not be lingering and a distraction during the trial. The court refused to do that, stating that he did not put them in this situation and wasn't going to bail them out or hold their hand. And again, the judge kept saying this would be handled after the trial. An indication of the heated nature of this issue, this discourse, is the trial judge stating that, so in my best abilities to step back and cool down and to calmly, objectively look at the situation, I have determined there's no way out of it. After this, Mr. Dean did not have any confidence in the representation by his counsel before this judge in this matter, and he said it's his right to defend himself, and that was what he wanted to do. Mr. Dean had also been told that this was a bad idea and not one that was recommended. Under Feretta versus California and State versus Gibson, the decision to represent oneself must be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. The court stated that he was not questioning Mr. Dean's intelligence and several times had told Mr. Dean that he was articulate and well-spoken. The court went over aspects of the trial that Mr. Dean would be responsible for and that he was indicted on 16 counts and the necessary prerequisites that he needed to be told. And Mr. Dean expressed complete understanding to all these requirements. The trial court then asked Mr. Dean if this decision to waive was based on any threats or promises that had been made to him, to which he responded no. The court then asked Mr. Dean if this was a voluntary decision, and he replied that yes, it was. Mr. Dean then made the statement that he wanted the record to reflect that he was doing this under duress due to this trial judge not addressing the ethical issue raised about defense counsel. The court stated that his using the word duress was a problem. And the court stated that he was going to contact the psychologist to get his opinion on Mr. Dean's ability to waive counsel and would give Mr. Dean a night to think about it.
Ms. Sanford, if I could stop you for a moment. I know we have the obligation to review these death penalty cases, and we all know that death is different and we take these cases very seriously. You have filed a large brief, and we've read the brief. Many of the facts that you've been mentioning here are already known to us, and you're basically touching on a number of issues, whether the judge should have remained on the case, whether the attorney should have remained on the case, whether there should have been Mr. Dean representing himself. Can you kind of let us know what is your most significant argument here, and then maybe we could proceed from that?
That Mr. Dean should have been allowed to represent himself.
That's your biggest argument?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
All right.
Yes. And the next day, Mr. Dean retracted using the word duress and said that he was completely confident to represent himself and he could proceed immediately, and this was not for delay. And the court said it would not accept the waiver because Mr. Dean stated he was being forced to make this decision by using the word duress.
The basis of his request for self-representation, however, was a direct result of the conflict between the trial court judge and his defense counsel. Am I correct about that?
Yes, that is correct.
And so the core problem is really the antagonism between the court and counsel, isn't it?
Yes, if there had not been that issue, Mr. Dean, in all likelihood, would not have asserted his right to represent himself.
So shouldn't we be directing ourselves to whether the court could fairly and impartially preside over a proceeding with that atmosphere in the courtroom?
There is the issue of whether or not the court should preside, as well as whether or not he should have allowed the defense attorneys to withdraw.
Well, the defense attorneys felt, and they expressed on the record, that they had been put upon by the court, who challenged them for asking that the court be excused or the court recuse on the case.
Yes.
And the court took umbrage at that.
Yes.
What effect should we give to that conflict or that atmosphere in the courtroom?
The atmosphere was certainly volatile, and Mr. Dean's rights were certainly not upheld. It was not a fair trial for him. There was too much going on between the trial court and defense counsel.
What was unfair about, you said the trial wasn't fair for him. I think there was a continuance to examine a witness that was, and they requested a 10-minute continuance to talk to a witness that was denied. What other manifestations of that unfairness are there that you can tell us about?
Well, in the affidavits of defense counsel with their motion to withdraw, they talk about that this is now, you know, it's creating a chilling effect on their representation of him, and either consciously or unconsciously, it will affect their decisions from then forward in representing him zealously and effectively, and they did not believe that they could, you know, represent him in that way any further.
What effect should we give to the request that was made to the Chief Justice, Tom Moyer, to replace the trial judge when the affidavit of disqualification was filed?
When the affidavit was filed, well, the trial court did not, in the trial court's response to that, the trial court did not have the state's response to look at to say that he thought it was a calculated scheme to have him removed from the case. So that was not all of that was in, obviously none of that was in the motion to disqualify the judge. I mean, the trial court didn't know that Judge Rastatter was going to have this reaction to the state's response in opposition to the judge being disqualified from the case. I mean, the Court of Appeals said that in the contempt proceeding, said that what it took notice of certainly was the judge, and when the judge found the attorneys in contempt following the trial, and he wrote in his contempt finding that there was a personal revulsion against, that he felt defense attorneys had a personal revulsion against the court based on when the court had been an assistant prosecutor. And the Court of Appeals said this certainly showed that the judge was not impartial and was very embroiled in this controversy.
Should we consider that aspect, or should we, that's the Monday morning quarterback look at it, or should we consider the view that Chief Justice Moyer had when he denied the affidavit of disqualification and said that the trial court could remain and be fair and impartial in the trial?
with what was before Chief Justice Moyer, obviously we have to defer to that. We do. But that was not, he did not have all the
information.
Yes, Your Honor, sorry.
Ms. San-
we all should.
What weight should we give to Mr. Dean's own statement during his questioning regarding self-representation? The record shows he says, I don't feel, he's talking to the judge, I don't feel in any way that you're biased against me, prejudiced against me, have a vendetta against me. That's stated on the record to the judge.
Yes.
What weight should that be given?
That can be given, I mean, Mr. Dean, that can be given weight. Mr. Dean was saying that he didn't feel the judge was biased against him personally. He felt the judge was biased against the attorneys who were representing him.
Is it therefore the conclusion that if they're biased against, if he's biased against the attorneys, the defendant here is going to suffer, even though the defendant doesn't believe that's the case?
Yes, because then the representation of the defense attorneys will be compromised.
And how, give us an example of that.
Well, they stated in their affidavits that they would feel, they wouldn't feel that they could zealously and effectively do all that they would normally do in representing
did
someone.
Did they illustrate what they would have done had they not felt compromised?
They didn't in their affidavits because they were before the actual trial started.
Okay.
They just said they felt that they would be compromised
we feel, we don't know what the trial is going to bring, but we feel we're not going to be able to give it 100% because of our relationship with the judge.
With this threat hanging over them throughout the proceedings of the trial. Yes, because they would be concerned about, in one of the affidavits, I believe it said, he would be concerned about, you know, his livelihood, his liberty, and what was going to happen to him after trial, if there would be sanctions, ethical violations.
But whatever had happened at that point, whatever was the subject matter of the post-trial activity with the defense counsel had happened, and it was not based on a performance in the court or in the trial, correct?
I'm sorry, you're talking about the contempt finding?
Yes.
The contempt finding was based on everything to do with the certification hearing.
Pre-trial.
Yes.
So there was nothing that would have contributed to the contempt that took place during the trial.
That is correct.
So they were anticipatorily predicting that they would have subpar performance as a result of what they did pre-trial.
The threat that was made to them pre-trial, yes. That they said was causing them to have a chilling effect. And even during the trial, I believe after the second or third witness, one of the trial attorneys put on the record that he didn't want it to appear that because he was present, that he was not still standing by his affidavit, that there was a chilling effect upon his ability to represent his client.
Well, don't you think it would have been more meaningful had he been able to put on the record at that point what he would have done had he not felt this chilling effect? I mean, what you're telling us is unfounded at this point, that there was a subpar performance based on anticipation of disciplinary or contempt issues hanging over his head. And that's speculative, and there's nothing that you're telling us or that was contained in the record to illustrate that.
Well, we did raise instances of ineffective assistance in proposition of law. I don't know. I don't have the exact number.
Right. I don't know. You started with the voir dire and moved on. But you know, if we don't see that as ineffective assistance of counsel, I guess those are kind of... What is alleged as ineffective assistance of counsel is no different than some of the other allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel that we have seen in other cases. There's nothing here that in the ineffective assistance area that I think would directly point to the fact that the attorneys were intimidated so they didn't zealously represent their client, and that intimidation was a result of the pre-trial discussions with the trial court.
The instances of ineffective assistance did affect Mr. Dean, however.
Pardon me?
I mean, the instances of ineffective assistance that we raised were on the record. I mean, can we say that those would not have occurred otherwise? No, of course not.
Counsel, I wonder if you could help the sequence of events here. The the issue of judicial bias or even hostility between counsel and the judge started with the hearing to certify that the prosecution did not have to turn over the address of a witness because of threats made against her, right? That was the first step here. And then the defense counsel moved to have the judge, ask the judge to disqualify himself because he presided over that hearing, disqualify himself from the trial, which he declined. And then defense counsel filed with the Chief Justice of this court a motion to have the judge disqualified because he had presided over the hearing to certify the witnesses as needing protection. But in that filing with the Chief Justice is when the state alleged that the defense counsel had set up this process to essentially remove the judge from the case. But the judge learned about this after the Chief Justice had turned down the motion to disqualify. Is that the sequence of events here?
It is. The trial judge put on the record, however, that when he received the notice from Chief Justice Moyer that he was not being disqualified, that the time that he received that, it appeared the trial judge had that Chief Justice Moyer had the trial judge's response, but not the state's yet. The state's was filed later in the afternoon after the Chief Justice issued his decision not removing the trial judge. So he put that on the record that that's what his understanding was from the date that everything was filed. So the Chief Justice had the trial judge's response, but not the state's yet.
All right. And then the trial judge learned about the state's response, and the wheels began to turn, and then that's when the animosity, I guess, or problem between the counsel and the judge began to come out into the open. Is that
correct? Yes.
Right. Thank you.
Because the trial judge felt that the defense counsel had known about State versus Gillard or Gillard 1, because there are a couple different Gillard cases, prior to filing the motion to have the judge recuse himself and prior to the certification hearing, that they knew about it. This is what the judge asserted, that they knew about it but didn't let the judge know that he wasn't actually supposed to be sitting on the certification hearing because he could hear that my client was, dangerous, and then also hear the trial. Mm-hmm. That's what it was based on.
Ms. Sanford, I want to follow up on that point. Was there an obligation on defense counsel, or should defense counsel have informed the judge about the possible requirement of recusal before that 16B1E hearing went forward?
Trial counsel stated that they were not, did not recall or were not directly aware of Gillard at that time, that it mandated the trial judge not to hear the certification hearing as well as then the trial, that they remembered it or read it again later after that fact. This came out in the contempt proceedings. And also trial counsel did ask the question, if they had a case, were they obligated to inform the court about that? And so that was a question, certainly. And the trial judge felt that they did know about it and they knew the holding, and that they should not have then asked the trial court to hear the certification hearing and not say anything about State versus Gillard and then filed the motion to recuse the judge.
You have an opinion on whether the prosecuting attorney should have informed the judge?
Again, in the certification hearing, the prosecuting attorney said that he was not aware of the Gillard case either at that time.
So the judge didn't say anything about disbelieving the prosecutor, only about disbelieving the defense counsel?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And this, the hearing was not really an evidentiary hearing, was it? It was just essentially oral argument.
The certification hearing?
The certification
hearing. It was just the prosecutor presenting information. And actually, it was information that they had that the co-defendant had made a threat against this particular witness, not even that Mr. Dean had made a threat. But yes, it was not an evidentiary hearing. Mr. Dean should have been allowed to represent himself when he asserted his right to do so. It was a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. And when he used the word duress, it was not in the sense that would make his decision not voluntary. Duress would be when an action was taken, you know, pursuant to a threat, a force, coercion, intimidation. None of that was present in this case. He did not have the proverbial gun to his head. He knew what he was doing. He weighed the pros and cons of the situation, the con being he's being forced to be represented by attorneys who have a completely antagonistic relationship with the trial judge, and this is a case where he may be sentenced to death. He was competent. This was not for delay, and again, he made the decision of his own free will.
And counsel, are you suggesting that despite this atmosphere and despite Mr. Dean feeling that his lawyers weren't going to be as zealous as they might otherwise be because of the animosity, that alone isn't enough to make his desire to represent himself an involuntary choice?
It was not an involuntary choice, no, Your Honor. It was a voluntary choice. He knew what he was doing. And for example, if I may cite to another case, in State versus Taylor before this court, Taylor was upset with his attorneys and he said, I'm probably making a bad decision doing this, but it's the only decision that I can make. I'm being forced to do it because this is the only chance that I have got for things to be presented how I want. So again, in Taylor, he felt he's making a bad decision, I'm being forced to do this, and that was upheld as a voluntary waiver. I mean, Mr. Dean knew what he was doing. If he did not make a motion to represent himself, he would have been represented by the counsel he was represented by. There weren't any repercussions to him forcing him to make this waiver. He made a decision based on evaluating what was going on at this time in his trial, and he just felt he's better off representing himself because he personally doesn't have this conflict with the trial court that his attorneys do. He stated, and Mr. Dean stated, he felt that the trial judge had taken this personally, that his personal problem with the trial attorneys, not with Mr. Dean himself. And so I would say, Your Honor, yes, it was a voluntary decision by Mr. Dean.
I wonder if you could provide any other manifestations other than the denial of the continuance to examine one of the state's witnesses.
For ineffective assistance?
In connection with your claim of ineffective assistance.
Yes, I can. First of all, defense counsel, they did not cross-examine many of the state's witnesses. They failed to present mitigating evidence that was readily available to them. Mr. Dean had to have insulin shots given to him during the trial. He has a severe form of diabetes. They did not present that. At one point, they failed to object to a photo array that was the subject of the motion to suppress. And when asked why there wasn't an objection, defense counsel said that he had something else on his mind. He didn't even think to make the objection. Along with a failure to object to instructions given by the court. That's in a nutshell what we raised in the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. There are other issues within that proposition too. But certainly the statement of he had something else on his mind.
And your claim is that he was concerned about the contempt hearing that the court had indicated would be held at the conclusion of the trial based on the earlier activity.
That is our assertion from that, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That because in their affidavits they also said this is what they're going to be thinking about throughout this entire trial. That's why they will not be effective, or at least as effective as they should be or normally would be, that their representation is compromised.
Because of some sanction that might be imposed by the trial court.
Yes, and that was basically said to them throughout different times during the trial. It was said, I'll deal with you. The trial judge said, I will deal with this later. I said this, and I'm not going to prejudge this, but it looks you have valid concerns about it. You know, this was on the record, and Mr. Dean knew about this as well. So that's what resulted in Mr. Dean wanting to represent himself and the attorneys wanting to withdraw.
Thank you.
Counsel, are you saying that the attorneys for Mr. Dean, did they sign an affidavit also admitting that they were ineffective?
They signed affidavits with the motion to withdraw stating basically, we don't know how.
And again, this is pre-trial.
Yes.
All right. Subsequently, did they sign an affidavit stating that they delivered ineffective assistance at counsel?
I do not believe with the post-conviction that there are affidavits. No, Your Honor.
Well, wouldn't that have been helpful to your position here if they're talking about how their minds are elsewhere and isn't that what would be the crux of your ineffective assistance? Why wouldn't they admit that?
Why would they admit that?
Why wouldn't they?
If they did, it would have to be with the post-conviction, I believe. I don't believe there are affidavits in the post-conviction. I don't know if they thought it was evident from the record because they had everything preserved pre-trial. In terms of the motion to withdraw the affidavits that they filed, and during, like I said, during the trial, one of the attorneys stated, just because I'm here doesn't mean I don't feel the same way, that there's this chilling effect over me.
Ms. Sanford, I'm going to turn to a different one of your propositions, that regarding judicial bias. Can you give me a very simple, straightforward, best argument for why you believe there's judicial bias here?
Judicial bias would be because the trial court stating on the record that there is an issue here. He's telling Mr. Dean that your attorneys are correct in being concerned that something will happen to them because the allegations look to be corroborated to me. And basically, this the atmosphere created by the judge. I mean, he tells them at one point to basically suck it up, be professional, and do the best you can do. And then he's got this threat hanging over their heads. That's a very unrealistic expectation. And the fact that on the day that the judge filed the sentencing entry, which was June 6th of 2006, at the same date, same time, he filed his criminal contempt finding. I mean, the bias against the attorneys was there throughout the entire trial. He never let it go. Because he didn't allow the motion to withdraw, forcing them to represent a capital client with this threat hanging over them throughout the entire trial certainly shows that he was biased, and his finding in the contempt that he felt there was a personal revulsion against him, I mean, shows that there is bias in that situation.
Thank you.
I see that my time is running down. If I could conclude at rebuttal, if you don't mind.
You may.
Thank you.
Mr. Shoemaker.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. I do want to put this controversy in somewhat perspective, in that the situation arose when we provided an answer to the affidavit of prejudice, which was filed in this court before Chief Justice Moyer. And I think what brought this to a head was, in the interim, we had discovered a telephone call, which the court has before it, between the defendant and his brother, which occurred immediately after this certification hearing, where basically the conversation is, and I'm paraphrasing now, this is a tough judge. Brother says, yeah, you got to get rid of him. Defendant saying, we found a way to get this judge off the case. And the timing of that, and we did not put that in the reply in order to get defense attorneys in trouble. We put that in the reply to invoke the doctrine of invited error. I have known Mr. Mayhall and Mr. Butzker.
Excuse me.
Yes.
That was a conversation between the defendant and his brother, not the attorneys, correct?
That's correct, but it was
How do you relate it to the attorneys turning that into some ploy to get rid of the judge?
Because the content of what he was telling his brother was that we have a way to get the judge off the case. And the timing of that was very, very suspicious, Your Honor.
And did anywhere in that conversation he say that our attorneys have a way, or my attorneys have told me of a way, or I'm working with my attorneys to get the judge off the case?
To quote the tape, but if they find me guilty, I already know that the judge is going to hit me with maximum sentence on everything. They already told me that. Brother, oh yeah, that judge is no joke. Defendant, I might be able to get rid of him, though. They came to see me the other day, right? They told me the judge might be getting pulled off my case. Brother, get him out of there. Defendant, he might be getting pulled off my case the other day when he was in the courtroom and they was sharing that.
Now, that's a very different flavor of he might be getting off the case because we've filed an affidavit of disqualification versus we have a way to get him off the case. There's
no,
a difference
this,
there.
This was prior to the affidavit of disqualification. This was prior to any of this. This was immediately, if you check the timing,
yeah, but,
I think
but
it's
if the attorneys are saying we might be able to get him off, we can get him off the case or because we're filing, they knew they would be filing one, that's still a different flavor.
And that's up to interpretation, Your Honor. The bottom line was that the timing, at least to us, was suspicious in that, and we felt that given the situation, that basically we had this certification filed and the days coming up to the trial while we were busy getting ready for the trial, the defense immediately asked for this hearing. We were immediately called over to the courts, or I forget the timing, within a very short period of time. If you look at the hearing itself, as these hearings go, incredibly innocuous. There wasn't even an allegation that this defendant made threats. The allegation that was in there is that this witness had been threatened after she had testified in a co-defendant's case.
Well, how do you now deal with the conundrum of
A, the judge was biased against these defendants' attorneys, not the defendant, but the defense attorneys, and chilled their conduct. And if you don't accept that, then why would not the defendant be allowed to represent himself as a true voluntary act? I mean, you've got, it's like one or the other. Either it was voluntary and the judge should have let him represent himself, or it wasn't voluntary because it was being forced upon him because of the judge's animosity toward the defendant. What's your argument against that?
On the self-representation issue, Your Honor, it comes down to a very, very basic question. There's no question a defendant has the right of self-representation. That right is not self-affecting. There is a procedure that's set forth in the law, and if the court examines that record, the trial judge was obviously very much aware of that law, went through a multi-day inquiry of the defendant, and things appear to be going in the direction where perhaps he would be representing himself. And then he says, I am under duress. You have put me under duress in this case. In effect, I don't want to do this, but you're making me do this. The judge then says, Mr. Dean, and examine the court's temperament and that dialogue going back and forth. He says, we're going to have to examine this. And I believe, if my memory's right, there was a break even overnight. And the next day, the court said, Mr. Dean, I can't have let you do this because you have said that you're under duress. And when you're under duress, it's not a valid waiver. There's a presumption of a waiver of this very important right.
That gets back to my question of why was he under duress? He says he's under duress because of the animosity with his attorneys.
Well, and that, when you go back to that, the question becomes another very basic question. As you well know, the trial arena, if you will, can be a tension-filled place. And there are things that go on in a trial. Not perhaps exactly like this, where there is tension amongst the parties, there is tension between the parties and the court. And if at that point in time, whenever there is that sort of tension, a defendant can claim, you're forcing me to represent myself, that puts the entire system in an untenable situation. In this particular case, how you look at this record, and Mr. Butz and Mr. Mayhall are professionals, and if you look at this record, they tried this case very, very well. They had an overwhelming case against them. They stuck to their theme. The one witness where they it's been raised that they didn't have a continuance, that witness was impeached so thoroughly in closing argument, I conceded to the jury that witness had been thoroughly impeached. So how I would respond to that is tension between a court, and this was a tense situation, no doubt about it, tension between a court and counsel does not automatically permit a defendant to say, I'm under duress. And quite frankly, if the court had granted that request and had him represent himself, I'm fully confident that we would be here today and we would be arguing different sides where the defendant would be saying, this was not a valid waiver, as we've seen other cases where we've had colloquies between the court and the right of self-representation was granted by a trial court, and higher courts or federal courts have said, no, you didn't do enough. Here, we have a flat-out statement by the defendant, and the question is, can he do away with that simply by saying, I retract? Procedurally, the court followed the exact procedure it should follow. The court is making a fact-finding determination here. He's looking that defendant in the eye, he's looking at the determination, and he's making a fact-finding determination. And if a defendant can overrule the presumptiveness of correctness of a court's fact-finding representation by simply saying, I retract, I don't think that's a proper rule.
Mr. Shoemaker, I want to go back. I, like Justice Stratton, was curious about the timing in connection with the 16B1E hearing and the affidavit of prejudice and the discussion that Mr. Dean had with his brother. It appears, and I think you're asserting, or at least the judge, believing that he was sandbagged, that this was a plan cooked up before the hearing. It seems from the timing that it's just as plausible and consistent with what Ms. Sanford said a short time ago, that it was only after the hearing that Dean's lawyers discovered this case of Gillard, discovered that there was a possibility that the judge would have to recuse. Why do you believe, or why did the judge believe, that he was, you know, sandbagged if the case wasn't discovered until later?
Well, I believe the timing of the events, the fact that a hearing was requested very, very quickly, it was granted without any objection, and then this conversation led to that inference. I am not here to cast aspersions. I am not here to try to say that and get inside the defense attorney's minds as to whether they did or whether they did not. What we were arguing is that we had a situation here because of what was set in motion by the defense, and apparently what was done immediately after that it was set in motion in this communication, apparent communication with the client, that they had a way to get rid of the judge. Now, unless that Gillard case was discovered in those what appeared to be a day or a few hours between when the hearing occurred and when he was obviously communicating this to the defendant, they knew about it ahead of time, unless they discovered it during that very short window of time.
How much time was there?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I know it was the events unfolded very, very quickly, and I'd have to go back and research
the record. Why did the prosecution not bring Gillard to the judge's attention?
I blew that one, Your Honor. I think that's in the record in another part of this case. I simply blew that. What I was concentrating on at that point, I had 50-some witnesses. I was getting ready for trial. My assistant did the certification. We were called over to court. We had a very innocuous hearing, and I admit it.
So
I blew that one.
We can believe you forgot about it, but we shouldn't believe the defense attorneys forgot about it or didn't know about it?
Well, I think the difference, Your Honor, is within this whatever very short period of time, I wasn't telling my clients we got a way to get rid of the judge. And whether that is proper or not proper, it's an inference. It's an inference.
Counsel, I wonder if we could perhaps get back to the possible bias of the judge. The briefs make some reference to this being a personality or professional conflict between the judge and these attorneys from some time in the past. I think maybe the judge makes the statement. I assume that maybe they have been involved in prior cases in which the judge was assistant prosecutor and they were defense attorneys and apparently developed some type of antagonism or something. Can you relate sort of what that was in the sense of trying to get as to whether there is a overall bias pervading the trial here?
I would have no idea, Your Honor. I can tell you that Mr. Butz and Mr. Mayhall are on many criminal cases. Obviously, my office prosecutes all the felony criminal cases in Clark County. We frequently lock horns, so to speak. We have sometimes profound professional disagreements. I like to think that they respect my office and my personal integrity, and I respect them and their personal integrity. I don't believe that's the case. But what I think the court needs to focus on here is the record itself and the professionalism with which when these contested issues came up. The record reflects that the court made a studied consideration of the law, of the facts, and the record does not belie this bias. And the record does not show any chilling effect. What the record shows is Mr. Mayhall and Mr. Butz tried a good case. And the record reflects that whatever feelings the judge may have had, he put them aside and followed the law. And that's what the record shows. There is nothing in this record whatsoever that points to bias. In fact, the studied consideration of the major events that occurred, if you go up to when we had the blow up with Crystal Caboose, the judge took a considerable amount of time and looked over that issue and came to a conclusion. When he was dealing with Mr. Dean, he took a considerable amount of time. He made a detailed inquiry under the law. And as Chief Justice Moyer points out, there is a presumption that the judge is not biased. And absent And absent compelling evidence to overcome that presumption stands. But just the opposite occurred in this case. Look at this record. The court, was there tension? Unquestionably. The court, it's very clear, put that aside and made the calls after studied consideration of the different issues in this case.
Counsel, an argument could be made, I believe, and I'm not making it, I'm just, I think I read it throughout the briefs here, that the way the judge handled this issue might be more of a problem than what the issue was itself, and that is that the judge refused to resolve the possible ethical problem of contempt or filing with the disciplinary authorities about the conduct of the trial attorneys while the trial was going on. And it perhaps would appear to a reasonable observer that this is sort of like a hammer or a hook or a club that the judge is now having over the attorneys, and whether it actually resulted in a manifestation of unfairness in the trial or not, the mere fact that it was present might be enough to violate one's due process rights to an impartial judge. Could you comment on that?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, while I may have preferred that the issue be resolved, our Court of Appeals has clearly stated the issue couldn't have been resolved. And because the Court of Appeals eventually ruled that in this kind of situation, the judge can't even sit on this kind of case. So the only way if the court was going to resolve this would have been for some sort of, unless he was going to say, okay, I promise nothing else is going to happen. But absent a studied consideration where he was trying to figure out whether he had a duty to do something, the only way it could have been resolved is to stop the trial, which was already underway, and at that point in time, appoint or get this court to appoint another judge to have a hearing, have an evidentiary hearing, which would have taken Lord knows how long, and then eventually either declare a mistrial or come back at a much later date when, quite frankly, 50 witnesses were scheduled and coming in from out of state and everything else, or the judge could do exactly what he did, and that was say, I can't handle this now. We're going to have to sit on it, and everybody's going to have to do their job. And in fact, everybody did do their job. The record just speaks loudly to that. They didn't have much to work with, but they worked very, very well. And the record would belie that. So the judge, unless the judge had said, okay, we're going to just forget about all this. I don't know whether you did something wrong or not, but we're just gonna wash it out and move on. And apparently the judge was unwilling to do that. And I'm not sure that the judge has any duty to do that, nor I'm not sure if he has not sorted out the entire situation that he can do that at that point.
But Mr. Shoemaker, the court says, the court maintains some very serious concerns about defense counsel and the manner in which they're operating in this courtroom.
Yes, sir.
I mean, those would be chilling words to a defense counsel, wouldn't you think? And then when the counsel asks to have the matter resolved, he says, well, we'll take that up preferably at the conclusion of the case, which is what Justice Kupp is getting to. It's sort of hanging it over their head throughout the trial. And that's what the essence of the complaint.
Under the law, I don't think, first of all, the judge had any choice. As an attorney that has practiced before this court and the courts of this state for 32 years as a trial lawyer, if you make the judge mad, excuse my language, you're going to have to suck it up and you're going to have to try your case and you're going to have to go forward.
But,
that's what professionals do.
The transcript reflects that Mr. Mayhall at a later point says, I would just like 5 or 10 minutes to talk with this witness, and you say, we have no objection. And the court said, wait a minute, there'll be no continuance. So even when the parties agree, we can take a 10-minute recess to talk to a witness, court decides, no, we're not going to do that. We'll just get moving.
In that particular case, if you read the colloquy beforehand, the defense attorneys had the substance of the testimony.
I understand that, but on the record, you've even indicated you didn't object to a 5 or 10 minute continuance to let them
prep that witness or talk to that witness in advance?
There's no question, Your Honor, that Judge Rastetter likes to keep his docket moving, and that is within the province of a trial court to do so. And in that particular witness, there's no question that the defense, irregardless, thoroughly impeached that witness to the extent that I conceded in closing argument that they had thoroughly impeached that witness.
Thank you.
Mr. Shoemaker, is it going to depend on the subjective interpretation of the record as to whether we find bias on the part of the judge here?
Well, I would submit, whether you want to use a subjective or objective test, there is a presumption that the judge is not biased. And absent compelling evidence to overcome that presumption, the rule of the court, as stated already in this case, is that the judge was not biased. And the record, I would submit to you, and I can't rehash the whole record in this short period of time, the record reflects that while there was tension, that was put aside, the judge did his job, the defense attorneys did their job, and the state of Ohio did their job.
So these unique statements that we've been talking about, I mean, typically they can be looked at either way. You could put a spin on it that it was positive or negative, but your point is that if you look at the rulings of the judge and the way the attorneys operated in the case, that there was no prejudice to the defendant insofar as their activities on his behalf.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I cannot think, there was an earlier question, I cannot think of what else they could have done. Mm-hmm. I really don't. They tried a good case. They're professionals. I've tried many cases with them over the years. I'm not sure that they've did anything differently in this case than that they've done when I've tried cases with them on many other occasions.
Mr. Shoemaker, you mentioned the Court of Appeals decision on the contempt, which ultimately said no, there was no contempt here. What significance, if any, should we pay to that decision now, where that Court of Appeals says the court's impartiality was impaired?
Well, with that decision is dealing with the court's impartiality as to render judgment on the defense attorneys, not on this defendant. And that's a very important distinction. The Court of Appeals was not speaking to the court's impartiality as to dealing with Jason Dean and dealing with the facts of the Dean case. The court there is saying that because of this tension between the defense counsel and the judge, we want another judge to deal with judging Mr. Mayhall and Mr. Blitz. I think that's completely. I think that's a very valid distinction. There's no further questions, Your Honor. I'd just like to say that the state of Ohio would ask this court to examine the record in totality. This is a case of overwhelming guilt. This is a case where, despite this tension that occurred, that the defendant received a fair trial. The defendant received effective assistance of counsel, and absent this court substituting its judgment for on the self-representation issue, absent this court mandating that when a defendant says, I retract, that a fact finder must accept that, the court made the proper decisions here, and we believe that all of these convictions should stand.
Mr. Shoemaker, before you stop, the question of the penalty here. We know that this was not the actual shooter in the case and that the juvenile who was the shooter received a life sentence. In this particular case, the jury recommended the death penalty, which was imposed. Do you want to comment upon that?
Well, normally not being the shooter obviously could be considered to be a mitigating factor. In this particular case, as I tried this case, I was struck by the fact that we had an older individual, very seasoned, if you will, as to criminal activity, who guided this juvenile into this spree, this murderous spree, and the evidence was that he attempted to be the trigger man, but either his gun malfunctioned, there's evidence in the record that the 25 round was left, and the 25 was the gun that Mr. Dean would have had, that somehow that gun malfunctioned and he was unable to physically pull the trigger even though he was trying. And as a result, his juvenile teammate pulled the trigger and killed Mr. Arnold. Now, under those circumstances, when you looked at the entire record and how this young man was driven into this life of murderous spree, if you will, by this defendant. The defendant actually attempted, except for a mechanical failure, he was not the trigger man. In this particular case, I don't believe that that's mitigating, because the record reflects, absent this fluke, he would have been the trigger man. He tried to be the trigger man, and even worse than being the trigger man, as a result, he led a juvenile into being the trigger man. And under those circumstances, I don't know how you can reward this individual for his gun malfunctioning and having, under the law, a child be the trigger man. Under those circumstances, and I've tried to think, and I was trying to think when I was preparing for this case, is there any other circumstance where not being the trigger man would be mitigating? And quite frankly, I'm not sure, and as I'm standing here, I can't come up with one. But my gut tells me when you try to be the trigger man, you virtually, the evidence would indicate from the round there that you pulled the trigger by the be the trigger man, and you had your juvenile, who obviously had far less experience than you do, as a result, pull that trigger and kill Titus Arnold. From my estimation, Your Honor, that's worse than being the trigger man.
The defendant was shackled throughout the trial, am I correct?
That's correct.
And the basis for that was what?
The judge put that in his entry. There was a prior robbery conviction, and during the pendency of this case, this defendant attempted to escape during the proceedings.
In the courtroom?
Not in the courtroom, from the jail. And as a result, the judge felt that he was a security risk. Now, quite frankly, I didn't object to him not being shackled because I didn't want to have to argue that issue here. And also, because
you're glad I brought that up.
Quite frankly,
you, huh?
as a trial lawyer, I wanted him to show himself. I wanted him to show himself to that jury. And if he had not been shackled, I truly believe he would have shown himself to that jury. And I or somebody else might have to absorb one blow from him, but I've got full confidence in our deputies that that would have ceased very quickly, and that would have materially helped our case.
Was this a situation where the jurors were not there when he was brought in and out, so they actually didn't see him walking in the shackles?
No, I believe at some point in time it was actually brought up in voir dire by the defense attorney, and different jurors were voir dired as to that fact. And during the trial, I brought up, when we brought Mr. Smith in, when we brought Mr. Manns in, we had them brought in shackles. So everybody that was brought into that courtroom that was in custody was in shackles. So there was no distinction between those witnesses and Mr. Dean. And I wanted that done to make sure there wasn't any prejudice, if you will. And I think it would be extremely naive for the jurors in this case to believe that Mr. Dean was not in custody at the time of this trial. So in this particular case, the judge put his basis and the decision for his basis in writing, and I believe that is a sufficient basis. Would I prefer that he not be and that he would have shown himself more? Yeah, and because I don't want this court to have any sort of inference, because I didn't object, that somehow I believe that he didn't need to be shackled.
Mr. Shoemaker, your failure to object there caused me to wonder. Argument could be made that this judge, throughout the proceedings, aligned himself with the prosecution team. Each time, and at least a number of times throughout, where you didn't object or you were agreeable to a defense request or motion, the judge went in your direction regardless. The instance of the shackling, the admission of photographs that you didn't even ask to have admitted, the request for continuance to spend 5-10 minutes talking with Mr. Dean prior to the witness. How do you respond to that?
Well, actually, there was a recess taken for Mr. Dean, for counsel to confer with Mr. Dean, and at the end of that recess, Mr. Dean decided that he wasn't going to testify.
I'm talking about with respect to the witness, the one that was discussed
Terry
earlier.
Smith?
Yeah.
It's the judge's reasoning is on the record that the defense counsel had more than adequate time to explore those issues.
I understand, but each time, what I'm suggesting is that one way to look at this is that on a number of occasions where you were either agreeable to the defense request or where you didn't object to the defense motion, the judge went your way regardless.
I believe, Your Honor, if you look at the record, it would reflect the judge's propensity to want to keep his docket moving, to want to keep the case moving, and not have unnecessary delay when he felt that there is adequate time and adequate preparation.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, the defense attorneys here, I'm presuming, were death penalty certified?
That's correct.
Do you know if the case State v. Gillard is part of that training for certification?
I can't speak to that, Your Honor. They don't let us in.
All right. I'll ask the appellant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Sanford.
Can you answer that question?
I can. I've been to many seminars myself, and I have never been informed about the Gillard case at the seminars.
It's not in the materials that are provided?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, no.
Can you know why?
I don't have an answer for that, Your Honor. Whether or not everybody did their job in this case is not the issue in terms of Mr. Dean's right to represent himself and whether or not it's a knowing and voluntary and intelligent waiver, which we, of course, assert that it was. Also,
well, counsel, whether anybody or everybody did their job is important here. The other important consideration is your client's mindset as to why he decided that he wanted to represent himself. But he was under the impression, according to his own statements, that it was necessary for him to represent himself. And that's one objection or one situation that we have to thoroughly look at. But looking at the entire trial and the record is extremely important to us.
I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying in terms of his waiver being knowing and intelligent, there was no question about that, and voluntary. He knew what he was doing. He made this decision certainly based on the situation he was in at the time between with the trial judge and the defense attorneys. But I was just saying, meaning that it's a voluntary decision. Him using the word duress, it wasn't a duress that he was under threat or compulsion or he was forced to make this decision. He just felt internally, this is the best decision I can make for myself given what's going on. And that was representing himself. In Gillard 2, State versus Gillard, but Gillard 2, this court addressed an attorney's conflict of interest issue and held that where a trial court knows or reasonably should know of an attorney's possible conflict of interest in the representation, the trial court has an affirmative duty to inquire whether the conflict actually exists, and also stated that where there is this affirmative duty to inquire, the U.S. Supreme Court has not required a showing of actual conflict or prejudice. And in this case, certainly there was that conflict of interest that the trial court should have inquired into. With respect to the certification hearing, that was conducted on April 24th of 2006, and the phone call from Mr. Dean to his brother was on April 30th of 2006. And which would support certainly that defense counsel were not aware or did not remember the Gillard holding at the time that they asked for the certification hearing to be conducted. And also defense counsel testified to that effect at the indirect contempt hearing, and again the judge there found that they were not in contempt. This case would determine whether Mr. Dean was sentenced to life or death. And his case was fraught with significant constitutional violations, including his right to represent himself, the right to the effective assistance of counsel, and to receive a fair trial. We ask that this court reverse and remand Mr. Dean's case for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sanford.